And we'll call the order of the House Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water. Welcome. We have a busy agenda today and a longer than ordinary hearing time. We'll be bouncing around a little. We're going to begin by hearing from Representative Cowan on House Bill 2009. We'll actually go into work session on that, but not for the purposes of moving the bill, rather to hear some follow-up testimony from what we heard earlier in the week. I think we'll have a special guest from the Senate and Representative Berger as well to kick us off on 3145, but we'll only be hearing that for the purpose of hearing their testimony. Then we'll move into 3170 and 3597, then back to 3145. So if you followed that, great. If not,
too bad.
And we're going to get started with the work session on House Bill 2009. So I'm opening that work session and inviting Representative Cowan to...
Thank you. I am in the
again.
Right place at the right time.
You are.
You are.
Perfect.
You are right place.
We'll try to just spend maybe about 10 minutes on this, though, Representative.
At most.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, that's entirely up to you. I just thought perhaps I could bring a little clarity to a couple of the things that we heard. For the record, my name is Jean Cowan. I am a House representative from House District 10. And perhaps in this context, Chair of the Coastal Caucus might be my appropriate role here today. I brought you House Bill 2009 at a previous hearing, and I did stay for that entire hearing and listen to all of the testimony. And there was one central theme that came up almost all the time, so I thought perhaps I could address it a little bit for you, and that was around the inclusion in the bill or the need for inclusion in the bill of the community team concept. To take you back just very slightly, you'll recall that after House Bill 3013 in 2009, we organized, and in that bill there was specific statutory reference, that's a hard combination to say, to the makeup, the individuals representing blank who needed to be part of the community team process. And gratefully, they were, and very important to the recommendations that came out of that process and went to the Ocean Policy Advisory Committee, and subsequently back to the legislature. There was no intent in drafting House Bill 2009 to eliminate that process, but the specific language and statutory reference to exactly what group someone should be representing and a formal structure of meetings was not included, because that process has actually culminated in the recommendation and then went to OPAC and came to us. There is, however, a desire to keep the individuals who are interested in this process and invested in it involved in the continuing conversation as this whole thing evolves. So we specifically worked with groups and added language in Section 2, page 1, line 27, the bold language that you see that says, and stakeholder interests associated with the recommendation, intended to be inclusive of anyone who continues to be interested post the community team process. There has been some request that similar language be included on page 3, which would be section 3 sub 4, when it talks about future decision making around whatever might happen as these things evolve, that same particular language should be included there. And that's what I was referencing when I said that at perhaps next session in 2012, if we need to come back and do some of that kind of fine-tuning, whatever we learn in the initial phases, that we could certainly do that, that there isn't any particular adversity to doing it. But that was how we kind of shortened that whole statutory chunk of language into making sure that the interested groups were still involved. And the other thing that I think... has caused some confusion is around funding issues. This does need a Ways and Means referral. The estimated cost, and I think I've got the financials in here somewhere, and I'm sure you'll have them, something around $1.6 million, partly from Parks budget and partly from Department of Fish and Wildlife. And that's the segment that needs to go through the Ways and Means process. It is currently budgeted. It was in the governor's recommended budget. And as we have been reviewing those budgets in the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Natural Resources, which I co-chair, we have maintained that funding. So we're sort of waiting for you to deliver this bill so that we can connect those two dots. The other section that has a $1 number in it, and it's confused almost everybody that's looked at it, is on page 4, section 7. And the reference there was devised by our expertise in legislative council and legislative fiscal office, and it's a reference to if at such point in time we decide that we have inadequate funding or there is some other sort of outside funding that might be appropriate to this process. There's been a significant concern that that might come with strings attached or a preconceived agenda. And how did we protect from that? So what we asked of staff was that they develop language that would put the same sort of constraints that you see through the Ways and Means process on other grant kind of requests where an agency comes and says, we have a possible grant for X number of dollars to do this, and we'd like your permission to apply for it. And Ways and Means says yes or no. And then when that grant is awarded, that has to come back to Ways and Means, and you go through a similar process, and you grant the authority to spend that money. That's the reason for the $1 line in there, is so that that appropriation could be adjusted if and when that sort of outside funding opportunity might be considered. But initially, in order to keep this very clean and without any concerns about any other influences, we're hoping to be able to maintain the budgeted amount within our own structure and begin to move this forward. So that's the reason for two kind of trains of thinking, I guess, around the fiscal piece of it. And I thought that that might be helpful if I clarified that just a little bit. Other than that, I just simply want to say thank you to the community teams, to all of the people who worked so hard and came here yesterday. I think you had a good example of what I was referring to when I suggested that everybody has a little bit of discontent, so we must have found a reasonable balance. And I also should have mentioned an inordinate amount of work on the part of Zach Reeves, who's come to us from Oregon Sea Grant as a fellow. We've been blessed to have someone from that organization come and work with the Coastal Caucus for the last few sessions, and he's done an inordinate amount of work on this particular bill development, and I'd like to recognize that and the work of the Coastal Caucus. So beyond that, I just want to make those clarifications. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them, or I'll get out of your way.
Thank you, Representative Cowan. We'll see about questions. On the fiscal piece, we do have a letter signed by the co-speakers adding the subsequent referral to Ways
Excellent.
And Means. Our expectation is that that's where it would head.
We're waiting there with
this
bated breath.
Very good, and hopefully you will get it. And I personally, that hearing was really fascinating, and I was impressed by the depth of feeling and the articulateness on both sides. People on this issue clearly with a great deal of affection and understanding of the coast and its resources, and really a great deal of admiration. I have a great deal of admiration for the Coastal Caucus that's worked so hard on this issue, trying to bring people together to find a way forward to move on something that's very, very challenging. So,
Mr. Chair, that was just a very small taste of the flavor of the conversations within the community teams process that went on for months. And I think many people join the community teams sort of envisioning that we go in, we lay it all out, let's get a decision made and move on. And particularly members of our fishing community who really don't have that experience with process. It was quite a learning experience for them, but they were very dedicated members, and certainly all of those viewpoints were expressed.
Any questions for Representative Cowan? Well, thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thank you for allowing me time to make those clarifications.
I'm glad you were here. We will carry over House Bill 2009 to April 14th, so a week from today. With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 2009. And we're being very careful and intentional in our carryovers, colleagues, because at this point, if we fail to carry over a bill that hasn't been posted already past tomorrow, then it does not survive. And so we're carefully and intentionally carrying over that bill until next Thursday. We are expecting Senator Courtney and Representative Berger to open up to talk to us on the bottle bill, and they're due at any moment. In the meantime, until they arrive, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3170, and I don't know if we'll get to the meat of this work session or not. Before they arrive, we might have to return to it, but Liz, can you just remind us what House Bill 3170 is?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3170 deals with the sunset on tax credits for diesel engines. Specifically, the bill would extend that sunset. There is a Dash 1 amendment before the committee at this time, and there is a minimal fiscal impact statement and a short revenue statement that was received, both as to the Dash 1 amendment.
Great. If there is any discussion, of course, we'll want to make sure we have time for discussion. If not, we can go ahead and move into motions on the bill. Let me just confirm. Okay, if that's, well, yeah, I'm gonna close the hearing and reopen it because we have Representative Berger here to speak on a different bill. So she may have stepped out, but we'll get her back. So we're gonna close the work session on House Bill 3170. We'll come back to it, members, later in the hearing, and we will invite Representative Berger to join us for first public hearing on House Bill 3145. And okay, so committee will stand at ease for 30 seconds. The audience will note that we try to show great respect and deference for our fellow members who come to testify, and so sometimes our schedule gets wrapped up around their schedules, and that's precisely what you'll see at a couple of points today. Come back into order.
Maybe we could take an informal vote on who we prefer, Courtney or Berger.
That's an easy
Berger.
One.
Who's coming into the room first? Liz, tell us about the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3145 would modify the definition of beverage, would allow the creation of distributor cooperatives, and would create certain accounting requirements and reporting requirements for those cooperatives. It would also change the refund value of beverage containers. The bill as introduced would make zoning changes regarding redemption centers as commercial uses. There is a Dash 1 amendment before the committee, and unfortunately we do not have fiscal or revenue statements yet on those Dash 1 amendments.
Great. Thank you, Liz. We will invite Senator Courtney, Senate President Courtney, and Representative Berger. We're very glad you're here. Please join us. The folks in the audience will know we've opened up this bill in order to hear your testimony. We'll be coming back to it later in the afternoon, but we're very grateful you're with us to help kick off testimony on this proposed change to the bottle bill.
Who would you like to go first, Mr. Chair?
Representative Berger.
President Courtney and I, for the record, State Representative Vicki Berger from District 20. Thank you all. Some of you know I have a lifetime interest in association with the Oregon Bottle Bill. It was my father's legacy, personal legacy to Oregon, but it isn't his. And that's its wonder and its power. The citizens of Oregon own their bottle bill in a very real way, and I think it's spoken to today by how many people are interested in this bill and anything that touches on the bottle bill. and the very fact that the President of the Senate is sitting next to me on this issue. And that is a really good thing. I'm only here to sort of stage this thing. You are about to enter bottle bill politics, and I welcome you to it. The bottle bill seems simple until you really start looking at it. And I think the bill before you, the amendments that you were just introduced, will prove it to you. There's a whole bunch of complicated moving parts in there. And that is the truth of the bottle bill. It isn't simple. It just seems simple. It's like a lot of wonderful things. We changed it dramatically a couple of sessions ago, and that has moved it to another place, and these amendments kind of speak to, okay, now it's a slightly different thing. And the thing that is dramatically different today is an idea that dates back to 1971 when it passed, which is the idea of separate redemption centers instead of grocery store redemption. That was in the original bottle bill. It was envisioned in the original bottle bill. And it's just taken quite a few years for us to get there. But we are well launched on this redemption center system. Thank goodness, because it gives lots of other flexibilities to the bottle bill as a system. But all of them come with puts and takes and changes that I think you'll see in these amendments. They aren't simple, and so before you is another sort of set of bottle bill issues for you to delve into, and when you're done, one way or another, you will be changed because you'll say, now I understand how complicated the bottle bill is. And I hope you understand that I support what you're trying to do here. I am not speaking to specific ideas within here because you have to fill in a lot of blanks within this, and you have the opportunity now to understand just how complicated all these changes potentially are. So I welcome you to it. I appreciate your interest, and I'm really glad to see you all join with all those behind us and on the internet in the great and abiding interest in Oregon's icon. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Berger. Senator Courtney, we're very grateful you're here and look forward to your comments.
Chair Cannon and co-chair Gilliam, vice co-chair Boone, Vice Co-Chair Krieger, Representative Witt, Representative Thompson, Representative Bailey.
Go ahead.
Representative Benz. He has no respect for me. He's never respected me. It is a high honor and a privilege to be before any House committee, let alone this, to be invited into your neighborhood. I always hesitate coming to the House because it's a special place, and I don't like to come unless I'm invited. And I was asked just 2 hours ago to come here and testify. Otherwise, I would not be here because I'm not about to tell you, any of you, how to run your neighborhood or how to do your business. So I am not here to do that. I threw together some thoughts because I, again, Peter Courtney, State District, Senate District 11, I every so often find myself asking Representative Berger at the cycling class at the Y, how are we doing on the bottle bill? Or I asked Senator Jackie Dingfeller, how are we doing on the bottle bill? And in order for me to do that, that probably means something's going on inside of me, that this thing means something to me. And I don't know what that's all about, and I don't, at my age, much care, because at my age, you don't do a lot of thinking about what's going on inside you, because, you know, time's precious. I even found myself asking the most honorable, supreme high Representative Gilliam at a recent other meeting we were at. What is going on with the bottle bill? Do something right, would you? Just do it and just make it happen, would you? And he seemed startled. Senator, Representative Bench was sitting on the other side of me, and I said, how's the bottle bill? He says, what's that? So that concerned me. But I do have an interest in this. You know, Oregonians like to be outdoors more than indoors. Oregonians like to keep their rest stops clean. Oregonians like to keep the beaches clean. And Oregonians like to take their cans and bottles back. It's not a Democrat, it's not a Republican thing, it's not a rural and urban thing. It's not an Eastern Oregon thing as opposed to Central Oregon or the coast or Portland thing. It's an Oregon thing. You know, in this business, you can learn a lot from experts if you listen. But everything I've ever learned about the bottle bill, I did not learn from experts and my fellow legislators. Now, I will not be able to claim what at least three of you can claim. I'll never be able to say I was a native Oregonian. And while I cherish my roots and my past, I'm a naturalized Oregonian. But if there was one reason I wish I could say I was a native Oregonian, it's because of this issue. I could claim that I was a native to the state that founded this thing called this bottle bill. And what I've learned most about it, I learned from Five Redemption Center at Fred Meyer's North out on Broadway in Salem, where I was Sunday night at 5 o'clock taking my bottles back. I go to take my bottles back. And I go to Fred Meyer's North as opposed to Fred Meyer's East or South. Sort of an economic thing. And I have learned so much about the bottle bill out there. I've learned that many people out there, I'm going to say it, they take those bottles back because that's the only way they can survive. They're homeless. I always know them. They've been coming back. They come back at all different times. They bring them back as of a fundraiser. Last Saturday, a certain team, well-known in this area, showed up at 9 o'clock. At 3 o'clock, they were still there, 1,600 cans. I was there when the poor people working there, the girl this time came out, because the machines clog and break down. They always clog and they always break down. They come out in all kinds of weather. I have memorized when I can come there, like on early Sunday morning, and nobody's there except the homeless. And I will tell you, while it's been a remarkable human experience to me, I've reached the conclusion, in my own humble way, there's got to be a better way. And what's challenging me here is I came to my own personal conclusions on this issue, that I had to make a concession, which I'll get to when I get through with this, that tells me that I really am more emotionally involved and care more about this issue than I ever realized. And I have not taken the lead. I've deferred to this committee, Representative Berger, and others. This is not, you know, this is your show, but I'm so gravely interested in it. Oregonians have never been afraid to be first or only. The first state to do something, or the only state not to do something, i.e., as well as self-service gas. Just try to introduce, say you're for self-service gas in the state. But we're the first state to do many things. We're just not afraid. We're not a following state. We're just not afraid. I don't know where that's coming from, but it's there. Lately, Oregon, she's been a little tentative in things, but she's never really been afraid. I coined a phrase, Representative Berger has just ridicules me. I call it first wagon. There had to be a first wagon on the Oregon Trail. You do understand that. There had to be the first wagon. Well, guess what? You, in this state, on this issue, are first wagon. You may not know where to go, but you're going to have to do it because you're first wagon. I've reached the conclusion that we got to increase the number of cans and bottles coming back. But, Peter, you got to make a major concession. You got to go for significant redemption centers. I never thought I would say that because I was so concerned if we did, the return rate would go down. I don't see any other way out of this situation now. So I'm there. Now, you're dealing heavily with triggers. Triggers scare me to death because the only triggers I ever hurt were in the budget. I still don't understand what I voted for or what they did. But they made people feel good enough that we got out of here. You got triggers. You got co-op issues. You got these pilot programs. But I'm going to leave this last thought. And I, God rest their soul, because my parents are gone. They're buried on the plains of Rhode Island. Years ago when I came out here, they finally talked my dear mother, who had Parkinson's disease, to get on a plane. She was terrified. She came all the way from Rhode Island to see her son, her middle son. And I put him in one of these motorhomes, because she was so disabled, it wouldn't work. And I took him to campsites in Oregon. And I drove my father crazy. My mother, I think, was driven crazy, but she dearly loved me, so she'd always defend me, my father. Because I tried to explain to him, you never leave a campsite in Oregon unless you clean it up. That's what Oregonians do. You don't leave a dirty campsite. And this bill to me is as much about that philosophically and symbolically. We don't leave our campsites dirty. We clean up our campsites. And, you know, I just can't say this enough. I think if you're going to be in the Oregon legislature, being a part of the bottle bill discussion, one way or other, is just what you are. And so you got a very tough task. I'm only here because they asked me to come. I'm watching this issue. I'll do whatever I can to help, but in no way do I want to micromanage you or second-guess you or any of those things. So I hope that coming here today that I have in no way distracted from your efforts. Representative Berger and I, different party, different philosophy, same neighborhood. Well, she's in the West Salem neighborhood. I'm in the North Salem neighborhood. The fact is that it's never been a DR for us. It never will be. It's part of who we are, and I hope that somehow you can reach that breakthrough. Find that sweet spot, that soft underbelly, that sweet spot. And, you know, in talking to each one of you, trying to make eye contact, that Representative Gilliam is looking at me the same way he did when I talked to him a few weeks ago. He does not respect me. He does not love me. But, you know, I come here for him. I come here for the reference that I have for this House. This may be the only time this session I've come to the House, although I got some bills. I think they're all going to die in the Senate. I'll come again. So you've allowed me to speak. I'll take any of your questions, comments, or your criticisms. But you know what? Saving Private Ryan, do you remember the battle in the Omaha Beach? You got to get to that seawall. You got to get to that seawall. You got to tear us to that seawall. Only you can do it. If you can't do it, we're not making it. We're not making it. You're either going to get us there or not. Now, I know Benz can get you there because we got there in transportation, and besides, he'll tell you he can get you there. I know Cannon can get you there because Jackie Dingfield tells me that. I know Gilliam can get you there because if you can't, I'm going to have to put up with him, and his idea of a sense of humor will drive me crazy. I'm done.
Senator Courtney, it is indeed an honor to have you here in the House. Thank you for addressing this committee. Let's see if we'll have any questions. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. A comment, if I may. First, I would like to point out for the committee that I do believe the vast majority of the characters die at the end of Saving Private Ryan. So, a little disturbed by the analogy. That said, Mr. Co-Chair, I do think it is a wonderful frame to begin this debate to have Representative Berger and President Courtney to remind us of the legacy that is the Oregon Bottle Bill. And it is a legacy that's been interwoven into the fabric of Oregon's history, but the stitching has frayed and is fading, and it's time for an update. And it's time for us to make it relevant for the next generation of Oregonians, and I think that's the task before us. And I want to commend Representative Berger in particular. There are few in this body who approach the honor and integrity that Representative Berger has. And last session, she had said over and over, let's get this right. Let's make sure that we do this right. And she has worked hard in the interim and brought the issues back before this committee in the effort to make that happen. I thank you for that, Representative.
Thank you.
Thanks for those comments. Any other comments or questions? Seeing none, you're excused. Thank you for
being
here.
Thank you. Good luck.
Thanks. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on 3145. We'll return to it in a bit. Let's go back, if we may, to
3170, reopen the work session on 3170. We heard the brief description of the bill, and I am prepared to take a motion on the dash ones. We're not.
Am I your guy?
I don't care who my guy is. I hope there's someone willing to make a motion on the dash ones.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gilliam.
I'd like to move the dash one amendments to House Bill 3170.
Okay, Representative Gilliam moves the adoption of the dash one amendments to House Bill 3170. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, the dash ones are amended into 3170, and perhaps the script, this does have a subsequent referral. Let's make sure we do it right.
Something you're doubting. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 3170 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the committee on tax credits.
Representative Gilliam moves House Bill 3170 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that be referred to the committee on tax credits. Is there discussion? Representative Bailey.
Looking forward to seeing this again and joint tax credits, Mr. Chair.
Oh, that's very good for you.
Any further discussion? Sue, will you call the roll?
Representative Bailey?
Aye.
Representative Vince?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Representative
Witt? Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Co-Chair Cannon?
Aye.
Co-Chair Gilliam?
Aye.
The motion carries. 3170 will move on to tax credits. Godspeed, good wishes, Representative Bailey. It carries our recommendation with this amendment, and we'll look forward to seeing how you dispose of it there. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3170, and we're going to open a public hearing, first public hearing, on House Bill 3597. We will get the list of folks who've signed up to testify, I think. I know there are three of you who made yourselves known to me in advance. If you want to come on up, we'll start with you. Mr. Simmons and friends.
Co-chair, co-chairs. My name is Mark Simmons, former speaker, have sat in that chair a lot of times. Happy to be back here today to recommend to you House Bill 3597. As you have been discussing, Oregon is a world leader in environmental sensitivity. We have a reputation for our environmental ethic that is known, in fact, worldwide. And the bottle bill that you've just been discussing is the icon of that environmental sensitivity that has spread far and wide. Recycling is important to Oregon. The recycling hierarchy that we have in statute was established in the 90s, I believe, and 80s, you say, Mary Sue?
80s and 90s.
And it was based on technology for recycling that was available at that time. Times change and technology changes that allow us to make better use of our resources in more practical and efficient ways that are more easily adopted by society. That technology has changed due to the creative energy of Oregonians. We have a technology that allows us to recycle our waste in ways that were only dreamed of 20 and 30 years ago and capture waste that is, in fact, in many cases, headed to the landfill, stuff we've been storing. Unfortunately, our statutory and regulatory framework have not progressed in a manner that would allow us to provide appropriate regulation to new technologies, and that is why we are here. That is why we have House Bill 3597 before you today, and to discuss technology that is birthed right here in Oregon that will, in fact, change the world, just like the bottle bill did. We have Mr. Chris Ulam from Agilex Corporation.
Thank you. Thank you, Mark, and Mr. Co-Chairs. Thank you for the opportunity to testify here today. My name is Chris Ulam. I'm with Agilex Corporation. We are a environmental services and alternative energy company headquartered up in Tigard, Oregon, and have been doing business in Oregon for the last 2 years after moving from Washington State. And I'm going to just give you a brief overview of what our company is and the technology, and you have some handouts that were distributed to you that I'll be following through. So I'm going to go fairly quickly, and feel free to give me any questions you have as I go through. So Agilex recently closed a fundraising round, a Series B fundraising round of $22 million, bringing in investment money from companies and venture capital firms like Kleiner Perkins out of the Bay Area, one of the few investments that a prestigious venture capital firm like Kleiner Perkins has ever made in the state of Oregon, with also additional venture capital money coming from Waste Management and Total Petroleum out of France. Since that time, we've already hired over a dozen people into our facility in Tigard, operators, engineers, salespeople, with more to come this year as we grow the company. You can see that we are patented technology with additional patents pending. The going to my third slide, the problem with waste plastics is that they're very difficult to recycle, and what makes waste plastic difficult is it's either very commingled, dirty, or some combination of the two. I have here a sample of that, and I think if I place it on the table, you may be able to see that. You may have to lay it on its side, it looks like. That's what our technology is focused on. It's focused on the type of plastic that would otherwise be landfilled, incinerated, or exported to a low-cost geography where they might be able to economically sort out the different types of plastics. So our technology does not compete with traditional recycling. We're in full support of the bottle bill that was discussed earlier. Rather, our technology extends the reach and the capabilities of recyclers in Oregon and around the world. The bottom line is that despite all of our efforts, our recycling rates in the United States are quite low on waste plastic, and most plastic is landfilled or incinerated on the West Coast, exported. Our solution, going to slide four, is based on putting the technology where waste is already being aggregated by haulers and recyclers, and it's a new tool in the toolkit for these recyclers and material recovery facility operators to add value and take these waste streams to their highest and best use, and in the process create a lot of clean tech jobs. What our technology yields is an ultra-sweet synthetic crude oil. There's a sample here. We are currently shipping that oil to a refinery in Tacoma, Washington, and have shipped well over 130,000 gallons since we moved into our Tigard facility about a year ago.
Could you hand those samples to the committee assistant? We'll pass them down the dais just so folks here can get a good look at
absolutely.
This.
Yeah, absolutely. So fundamentally, what our technology represents for the recycling industry, and again, we partner with recyclers. We don't compete with them. We're not trying to get into the recycling business. We're a technology provider to the recycling industry. What our technology provides is an opportunity to decrease the transportation, unnecessary transportation of waste to landfills, increased diversion rates, increased compaction ratios at landfills, because plastic is light and fluffy. It's 12% of the waste stream by weight, but 25% by volume. So it's not the kind of waste stream you want to be moving around unnecessarily. Therefore, an opportunity to get more recovery and increased profits for the recycling industry. Slide 5 is an overview of the process, and I'm not going to spend time on that, but for the technically oriented, you can look at that. The bottom line is that it's a technology that's aimed at dealing with truly difficult-to-recycle waste plastics, even plastics that contain PVC, for example, small amounts of PVC. So the plastic that goes into the system doesn't need to be sorted or cleaned up in advance. And as the next slide shows, a picture of our commercial system and a truck being loaded. We ship just another truckload on Tuesday of this week to the refinery and ship about every 2 weeks. So this is a very real, viable operation, and certainly any of you would be welcome to visit at any time. So just to wrap up, as Mr. Simmons said, the current statutory language, we believe, is a bit too subjective, and some clarity would help in kind of keeping that legislation up with the current state of technology. What we've experienced is that the current language creates a certain amount of confusion within the agencies with respect to permitting, as well as incentives like the business energy tax credit. The bottom line is this could have a very significant impact. We've already got over 30 employees in one facility, but this is the type of technology where you could have facilities in any in all corners of the state, you know, from Coos Bay to Ontario to Medford to Portland, and several within Portland, Salem, Eugene, Roseburg, Grants Pass. And so each of those would create 20 to 30 jobs. We're talking about the capability of creating scores and scores, hundreds of jobs in Oregon just with the waste streams that are currently being landfilled or incinerated. By our estimates, we could produce about 30 million gallons of oil just from the every year from the waste plastic that's currently being landfilled at someone's cost today and filling up unnecessarily rapidly that precious landfill space. In the process, divert over 300 million pounds of plastic a year away from that. And again, we're not competing with these folks. We're partnering with these folks. But the language in this current statutes is a bit dated and could, I think, we believe, use some clarity. So thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. I'll take any questions if there are any.
Thanks, Chris. Did you want to speak? Or are you?
Right. Yes, please.
Yeah, go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Co-Chairman and fellow representatives. My name is Mary Sue Gilliland, and I work for Agriplast, a plastic recycling company in Brooks, Oregon. I'm their vice president of business development. Prior to that, I spent 12 years with Far West Fibers in the Portland area. They are the largest material recovery facility, and I'll refer to them as a MRF, or that industry as MRFs, taking curbside material in the state. I also spent 4.5 years as the Oregon DEQ Solid Waste Policy and Planning Manager that had oversight of this type of technology. Today I'm here testifying in favor of House Bill 3597. Agriplast has processed over 8.5 million pounds of waste plastic in 2010 alone. The majority of this plastic that we process comes from the agricultural industry. This means it's dirty, and it's usually mixed resins. Resins, again, is those numbers inside the recycling aerials, the 1 through 7. For our products to be marketed profitably, it must be relatively clean and sorted by that resin type. Because our material isn't generally acceptable in your normal recycling markets, over half to three-fourths of our material goes to China or India for further sorting, cleaning, and processing. We do not view this as a sustainable situation for us, and we don't think it's environmentally conscientious. Again, I want to clarify that we are not a curbside MRF. We do not compete with them. We do not go after milk jugs and PET bottles that some people are concerned would end up in our oil process. They can be used in the oil process, but we don't specifically go after that or see hardly any of it. We started working with Agilex over 5 years ago to find an economic solution for our low-grade plastic material. They had the technology. We have the plastic. From June 2008 to September of 2009, we actually operated one of their vessels in our location in Brooks and generated over 4 tanker loads of synthetic crude oil during that time. We believe the technology has been proven. and we're ready to move forward. Not only are we interested in installing 16 of their units at our Brooks location, we've identified three other sites in Oregon that we believe is ready right now and could support an additional 40 units. That would create, we feel, approximately 140 sustainable jobs, not one-time construction jobs. There would be more jobs involved in the manufacturing of their units, but this would be 140 operators of this system day in, day out. These are sustainable jobs. Why hasn't it gone forward? We've encountered problems over the past 2 years, both in the permitting and financing arenas. That's why we're here today in support of 3795. We have run into one wall after another because no one can agree on what to call us and what box to put us in. We're not considered renewable energy, so we're not eligible for any of the packages that go with the ethanol people or the biomass people. We're not eligible, according to Oregon DEQ and DOE, because we're not recycling. We're not eligible. There's not a clear path to the Oregon Betsy program for us because we're not considered recycling or defined as recycling. We think that this has hindered us from attracting private investors. We think it's prohibited us from receiving public funding, and it's cost us additional fees for permitting. We believe that the crude oil that comes from this process is a product. We don't burn it for energy on site. We actually ship it to as an industrial feedstock to a refinery for further processing. We believe that we fit the statutory definition of recycling and should be exempt from solid waste permitting, just like the curbside MRFs in Portland, just like the Owens, Illinois glass plant, just like the sequential biofuel plants. These are examples of people that are exempt from solid waste permitting. We think this is a consistency issue. Instead, DEQ has required that we get a solid waste treatment permit. This is the most expensive, most onerous permit that they have. We are not a landfill. We don't believe that we need the level of scrutiny or financial assurance of a Subtitle D landfill. Okay. We have to pay DEQ under this permit a fee for all of our incoming material. This does not happen for clean MRFs in the state of Oregon. Calling us recycling gives us a clear path toward the Oregon Betsy. This would help us attract investors that would be willing to support this emerging technology. In 1993, the AG's office issued an opinion saying that plastic to oil, they called it pyrolysis, was not recycling. The Attorney General opinion, and I have copies of that available if you've not seen it, or I can, we can pass it out if you need, want to. But the AG opinion was based on intent of earlier legislation. If you read it, you will see that there are references to there is a clear expectation, quote, legislative intent appears to be, quote, appears to be what the legislature had in mind. It's not a policy opinion, in my opinion, that's based on policy and definition, but rather intent of that legislature at that time. We believe that House Bill 3597 asks this current legislature to provide us with more than intent. We need a clear definition and policy to satisfy our investors and to direct state government staff that regulate us and potentially fund us. You know, in the late 80s and 90s, gas wasn't $4 a gallon, and we weren't fighting in two to three foreign wars to secure our position with foreign oil. And China wasn't sending lead contaminated toys to Walmart made from our waste plastic. So times have changed, conditions have changed, circumstances has changed. We think that we need to change some direction too. Of the 8.5 million pounds of plastic that we recycled in 2010, that's down approximately 50% from where we were in 2008 when the economy crashed. We currently receive 2 to 3 calls a day about plastic material that cannot be collected curbside and is desperately needed to be have something done with. We're unable to take this material. because of economic reasons. We can't afford to clean it, sort it, process it, and ship it at a loss. We've done a lot of that, and we can't afford to do it anymore. The current solution for that kind of material is to bury it, burn it, stockpile it, and landfill it. We believe that this is a horrible waste of a valuable resource, and the support of this legislative body could help us prevent this wasteful practice. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions on this panel? Representative Boone.
Just a technical question. So I asked my very smart partner colleague here. This is what you start with. This is what you end with. And what is this?
That's what's left over. So when you process the plastic, there's certain amendments in plastic and carbon left over. So it's primarily carbon. Typically, if you start with 100 pounds of plastic, you're going to get about 80 pounds of crude oil. You're going to get about 12 pounds of light gases that are used in the process, methane, ethane, propane, butane, and you're going to get about 8 pounds of that, which we currently don't sell, but we give away to steel mills, to that solid carbon residual, and they use that in their process as part of their ordinary course of business. So it's one of the products of the process.
So this crude oil that you've got left,
yes,
you can make, then this could be refined into gasoline to run in cars, trucks, whatever, for fuel. And what else would you use this for?
Yeah, so the crude oil, depending on the type of processing plant, the type of refinery, certainly could be refined into transportation fuels like ultra-low sulfur diesel would be ideal because it's an ultra-low sulfur feedstock. It could also be refined into ethylenes and naphtha, which then goes back into the plastics production. It can also be used in pharmaceuticals, cosmetics, and synthetic lubricants and greases. So refiners are very good at taking a really incredibly versatile feedstock known as fossil crude and making literally tens of thousands of products. And our crude oil that's derived from our system would be treated in a very similar way. So about 8% of it on average would be most inclined to go back into more plastics products, but a full spectrum of things, some of which are durable and some of which, yes, ultimately are going to be consumed in the form of liquid fuel, transportation fuels. But our thought is it's better to get that from the MRFs of Oregon and the recyclers of Oregon than from countries around the world where frequently there's either geopolitical or environmental tensions.
Thanks. Any other questions?
Thank you.
It's a terrific project, and I had the opportunity to come out and visit when you opened, and it is a really impressive operation, bringing jobs to Oregon, helping create local sources for petroleum, and helping take some of the plastics out of our waste system. So I think it's a happy coincidence that we're hearing this on the same day that we're hearing the bottle bill, and appreciate your efforts in that regard.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. We will hear next from Holly Sears, Mike Dewey, and Palmer Mason. Holly, let's start.
Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Cannon, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Holly Sears, and I'm the Governmental Affairs Director for the Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association, or as a trade association representing private solid waste and recycling haulers, landfill and transfer station operators, material recovery facilities, and composters. We understand that this bill is a result of efforts that have been made to recognize pyrolysis conversion technology as a legitimate recycling process for plastic that would otherwise be landfilled. Although the technology is new to Oregon, the basic principle of transforming material for recycling is very similar to technology used for any other material, recycled material in the state. Paper is turned back into pulp, and plastic is turned into crude. Continued improvements to recycling processes, such as pyrolysis conversion technology, is one of the reasons that Oregon is one of the leading recyclers in the nation. We recognize that DEQ has not determined a clear and consistent approach to the type of regulation appropriate for these types of facilities, but we also understand the concerns of the proponents of the bill, and we would like to have an opportunity to work with DEQ, Agriplas, and other interested parties on the language of the bill, or an alternative solution to resolve the valid concerns of the proponents. Specifically, we feel there are policy reasons for maintaining a broad definition of recycling in statute and that there may be better language to consider to recognize and embrace this new technology. We understand that from DEQ that there is an AG opinion from 1993 that Ms. Gilliland spoke about that apparently has been the basis for treating this process differently from other recycling, and we feel it makes sense to reconsider that opinion. We also understand that the DEQ's inability to treat this technology as recycling because of that AG's opinion is jeopardizing the potential investment in green jobs in Oregon and has made it difficult for these companies to apply for the BETSI program, and we also think that that should be corrected as well. Thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ellie. Mike.
Thank you. For the record, Mike Dewey, representing Waste Management, Inc., also a member of Holly's Association. You heard earlier from the previous testimony that Waste Management has invested in the Agriglex process, their technology, and we are in the position now of siting a facility in Northeast Portland that would produce the crude oil that was discussed. Now, we also operate landfills, and we operate collection facilities, so we pick up the good plastic. And we see, we'll call it the bad plastic, if you will, that isn't recyclable under the, quote-unquote, the conditions that we're used to. And so we see that at the landfill. And we are in the landfill business, but notwithstanding that, we have invested in this. We will be using the technology. We have our LUX, our Land Use Compatibility Statement. I believe on Friday, we will be applying for our air permit from DEQ. There is an issue about whether or not we need a solid waste permit, and we're having that conversation. We don't think we do, and we think we can get through that. We've always felt that the process we're talking about today falls into the definition of recycling, number one. And number two, we would be eligible for the, which are somewhat controversial, as some of you know, the Betsy's, but nonetheless, we have applied for that with regard to this particular facility. The facility that we will be siting, and again, we're going to site this facility, I mean, this is going to happen, would produce about 1.6 million gallons of crude oil, 1.6 million of crude oil a year. And obviously, with what's happening with foreign policy and oil, that is something we ought to do. I want to make it very clear that our company is not going to be using the, again, good plastic for this kind of an operation. And I have for you, just show you this. This is from the city of Gresham. And it has, on April 23rd, Earth Day Free Recycling Event. And it shows all of the collection items and the plastics that are in this, lawn chairs, the rigid plastic. This kind of plastic, the plastic on the top of your coffee cup. So there's an array of that out there. With regard to the AG's opinion, I have not read it. I've seen parts of it, and it does appear to be somewhat ambiguous. I was involved in Senate Bill 66 a number of years ago, and clearly things have changed. So we do want to get a good path to what is good public policy here in terms of being green. And so we support the legislation. We don't want to have legislation that would be enacted that would somehow delay our project. We want to make that clear to you today. So with that, co-chairs, I will finish and answer questions at the appropriate time. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Mr. Dewey. Homer.
Co-Chair Canning, Co-Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality. I want to say that I think that House Bill 3597 is trying to tackle a couple of real problems, but I want to suggest to the committee that I think it may be going about that in the wrong way, and then I want to offer an alternative that I've spoken to Representative Gilliam, the sponsor of the bill, about, or his office about. I think the issues that the folks at Agilex and Agriplas and companies like that are trying to solve are good issues. They are right. There is low grade plastic that goes into the landfill, and that's not a good use of that plastic, particularly if we can convert it into something as valuable as fuel, and that in that process create jobs for Oregon. So I understand where they're coming from on that point, and I agree with that fully. The real issue, as I've understood it in talking to the proponents of the bill, has been the issues of permitting and the issues of whether DEQ has the right permitting process to deal with these new conversion technologies. And I would submit that they are right about that issue, too, that we do not have the right permitting process in place. And we have said this in the past, that we don't have the right permitting, and that needs to change. And as I say, in a minute, I'll explain an alternative that may help with that issue, if that is indeed the real problem. I did want to speak for a moment, if I may, on the Attorney General's opinion, the 1993 opinion, and shed some light on that. And while that is a opinion that speaks to the legislature's intent, I think it's also fair to say there are some policy reasons why the opinion is written the way that it is, and that those policies still hold value. It is, of course, the prerogative of this committee and the legislature to change that, and if that's what the legislature does, then DEQ will implement that. But I did want to share with the committee why I think some of those things have to be carefully considered. The Attorney General's opinion talks about using pyrolysis, the process that Agilex uses to convert plastics into fuel, which is essentially what they are doing. The Attorney General's opinion goes on to say, in doing that, you are taking the plastic, converting it into a fuel, and then burning that fuel for energy. And that is really closer to the definition of energy recovery that is in the statute now, and that's different than recycling. Recycling says, let's take the plastic, convert it into a new product, which I admit that's what Agilex is doing, is converting the plastic into fuel. But then, unlike the process that they use, when the plastic is converted into a new product, you recycle that plastic again, and it becomes a new product, on and on, so forth and so on. If I took a plastic bottle and I used the bottle bill to return that plastic bottle, water bottle, let's say, it gets converted into a product. That plastic can then be used again, melted down again, and used into another product, and that process can continue on and on and on. That's different than what Agilex is doing. They are converting low-grade plastic, which, again, I agree is a good thing. We should keep that stuff out of the landfill, and they're to be commended for that. But they're converting the low-grade plastic into a fuel, and when that fuel is burnt, there's no more material left. You converted the fuel into energy, and that's the end of it. There's no product to continually recycle over time. That was the logic of the hierarchy, where we say the most important thing to do is reduce waste. The second most important thing is to reuse. The third most important thing is to recycle, because we can use those materials again and again and again, and save energy by not having to harvest virgin materials. And then below that, we have, you know, composting, energy recovery, and ultimately landfilling. So that is why the legislature in 83 established the waste hierarchy and put recycling over energy recovery. And I, again, would submit, if you look at the definition of energy recovery, what Agilex is doing, it's closer to that definition because they're converting the material into actual energy. Again, the legislature can certainly change that, and the legislature is free to do that. So I just wanted to point that out to the committee. I did want to talk for a moment about the suggestion that I made to Representative Gilliam's office, and that is I recognize that the DEQ has fallen behind on the permitting, and that a solid waste treatment permit, as you heard from the person from Agriplast, doesn't fit well with these new conversion technologies. And we certainly shouldn't be putting up barriers to this kind of innovation and investment. So my suggestion was perhaps the bill could be redrafted, or at least this could be considered, where the bill would be drafted to direct DEQ to undertake that rulemaking, come up with a better permitting category that would fit these kind of conversion technologies. And I want to add that in the case of Agilex, as I understand it, the environmental risk is not great. And the rules should reflect that companies like that should have the lowest possible fees, and they should have the lowest possible environmental standards that are still protective of the environment. We should set regulations that fit the risk to Oregon. But that there have been cases where pyrolysis facilities have created problems for Oregon. Those have not been plastic pyrolysis facilities. They have tended to be tire facilities where an entrepreneur had an idea that I could convert tires into a fuel, and then found out later that the economics didn't work, the process didn't work as well, and left the state with a mess that was very expensive to clean up. And in that case, we need environmental regulations to prevent that from happening. And so we could set environmental regulations depending on the material used, the type of facility that was run, and make sure the fees are consistent with the real risk to Oregon. And maybe with that, with legislation like that, DEQ could come back, we would have a rule, and these folks could get their permits, and permits that would better fit their situation, because I'll acknowledge that right now our permits don't fit their situation very well. And with that, I'll stop and take any questions.
Thanks, Palmer. Let's see if there are any quick questions. We have a legislator here on back to the bottle bill, but we'll see if there are any quick questions for any of these three.
We'll come back to Palmer on this.
If you'd like.
I bet you you're sticking around for the rest of our
show. I will. I am.
So let's go ahead.
Shall we take the other testimony?
Please.
And then come back right with any questions for Palmer on this.
Only because it's Johnson.
Thank you. With that, we will continue this awkward dance. We will close House Bill 3597, but we'll return to it. We will open House Bill 3145, reopen House Bill 3145 for the purpose of hearing our colleague, Representative Johnson. And friends. Well done, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Cannon and Chair Gilliam. My purpose here today is to introduce a couple of constituents from House District 52. They're here to testify on behalf of House Bill 31. Oh, pardon me, Representative Mark Johnson, House District 52. Here to introduce a couple of constituents, we have Allie Danko and Alex Melton. They are a couple of Hood River Valley High School's best and brightest. They are excellent students, thoroughly engaged in all kinds of service projects in Hood River County, and they're here today to share with you their feelings about House Bill 3145.
Thank you.
Thank you for letting us speak to you today. I'm Allie Danko, and this is Alex Melton. We're both from Hood River and members of the Hood River Valley Leos Club, which is a teen service club affiliated with the Lions Club. We have about 80 members, and our club has started many local projects. One of the main projects that we have started and we are involved with is our recycling program, which we started about 2 years ago. Every month, in rain or shine or snow or hail or intense Hood River wind, about 15 Leos collect deposit cans and bottles from community members, and we sort them, and then they are picked up by the Oregon Beverage Recycling Co-op, whom we are very thankful for helping this project happen. All of the money that we make from these deposit bottles and cans are donated back to our community in the forms of local organizations like our local food bank and Big Brothers Big Sisters. Since January of 2009, we have collected and sorted over 200,000 deposit bottles and cans in our community and donated over $10,000 back to our community.
So the reason we're here today is to discuss several of the inefficiencies we've seen in the current system and the ways that this bill would help fix some of those.
And will you introduce yourself?
Oh, I'm Alex Melton. And so when we sort the donations that come in, we sort them by the type of container, the size, and whether or not they're distributed by the local Pepsi distributor. And we also sort out any non-deposit items. So in our experience in the community, we've seen that the easier it is for people to recycle, the more they'll want to do it. So when we started this project, it was most of the people who were bringing in their bottles were people who had been recycling their deposit items curbside. But now, by making it easier through our project, we're helping out the community. So one problem that is a barrier for people recycling is that they don't know what has a deposit and what doesn't have a deposit. So they either recycle everything curbside or worse, throw it away, and don't claim the deposit. So even just this last Saturday when we were doing our collection, a woman came by who was surprised to find out that even water bottles have a deposit and told us that she had been throwing all of her water bottles away. So the details of what has a deposit and what doesn't have a deposit is really hard for people to remember, and adding deposits to more bottles would eliminate such confusions and increase the recycling and redemption that happens in our communities. Another thing we see is that people drop off non-deposit items to us that they think they're donating and doing something really great for the community, when really at the end of every collection we end up with a bunch of bins of non-deposit items. And we see this as a loss of resources to our community because they come with the intent to donate and they don't know what has a deposit and what doesn't, so they're not actually donating to the community. So if we put deposits on sports drinks, juices, teas, and other non-carbonated beverages, it would eliminate a lot of this confusion and make the system more efficient and more widely used.
We see many benefits to having a 10-cent deposit on these containers. From our experience in the community, people don't want to waste time with the dirty, unreliable machines just to get 5 cents back per container. They get frustrated, and they have told us that they don't think it's worth it. So they end up recycling them curbside or throwing them away. If there was a 10-cent deposit, we believe that there would be more motivation in our community to recycle and redeem the deposits for these containers. Also, in projects like ours, if there was a 10-cent deposit, there would be double the money going back to the community. For example, if we had a 10-cent deposit now, our Leo's Club would have been able to donate not $10,000, but in these past years, over $20,000 back to our community through different programs, which would make differences in even more people's lives. Also, because our Pepsi distributor out of the Dalles has not signed on to the Oregon Beverage Recycling Co-op, we have to hand sort out every individual Pepsi brand container, which includes not only Pepsi itself, but brands like 7-Up, Squirt, Dr. Pepper, Aquafina, and more. And we have to separately bag them and drive the bags to the Dalles, which wastes time and gas. If every distributor was on the same page, we feel that it would save groups like us much more time and energy.
So for our project and other projects like ours throughout the state, we think that this bill would really add some efficiency to the system, and it would double the amount of money that we're able to give back to the community. So please pass this bill that would add deposits to more bottles, increase the redemption value to 10 cents, and get distributors on the same page. We urge you to consider the impacts that this bill would have on communities and projects and the residents of our state and the convenience and use of our recycling system. And thank you very much for your time. We'd love to take any questions.
Thank you, Allie and Alex. Terrific job. Allie, your father casts a very long shadow over this committee. I don't even know if he knows it, but the Attorney General's letter that was referred to in the previous bill is actually addressed to him from 1993. And we're grateful that you are here today, and you as well, Alex. Are there questions for these two? Seeing none.
Thank you, colleagues, for your graciousness. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. So with that, we will close, but not forever, the public hearing on 3145. We will reopen on 3597. I think my co-chair had at least a question for Mr. Mason.
Hold on.
Hang on.
I'm sorry. First of all, I very much appreciate your coming, and I appreciate your openness to discuss this. I'm sorry that my co-chair keeps me so busy that you and I couldn't talk, but I want to talk about those items. I was briefed on what you talked about, and I think we've got a little discussion. So I won't prolong this, but we'll look forward to that offline the next day or two. Is that all right? But thank
Absolutely.
You. Okay.
Very good. And so we will stand at ease for a moment, and committee, you'll see more of this over the next 2 weeks as the co-chairs confer about next steps with each of these bills. So we'll stand at ease for just a moment. Order, and we will carry over the work session on 3597 for Tuesday, and if necessary we can take it one or two committee hearings beyond that, but not much longer. I think we closed the works or closed that hearing, so we will reopen the hearing on we'll reopen on House Bill 3145. Back to the bottled bill. We have a page of folks signed up to testify. There may be another. I don't know if there's another sheet out. If so, we'll get that. And let's begin. Mr. Romaine, Mr. Miller, why don't you kick us off?
Do you have to say the names?
Okay, thanks.
Do you have to say the name
again? The bill number? For this?
Did I go back to the bottle bill?
Oh, I think I said 3145. Oh. We're in public hearing on 3145.
Yes. I think so.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. You'll have to excuse me because I've got a lozenge in my throat, because if I don't have this in my throat, I'm worse. So I will try and be reasonably brief, which is quite uncharacteristic of me. I'm Paul Romaine, the attorney and lobbyist for the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association, and I've had a hand in at least attempting to craft some of the concepts that are before you in the -1 amendments to 3145. If you can't understand me, please raise your hand and I will attempt to use sign language. Just a little bit of background on the bottle bill. For most of its existence, it covered very simple products that were in exclusive territories. In other words, I know I sound awful, sorry, it's painful to listen to me, even for me to listen to me. But so when we added water to the bottle bill, we had to change the whole method of trying to do the collection. The sodas and beer were distributed pretty much in exclusive territories around the state. When we went to water, we did it really, we pleaded with people to let us do it on an experimental basis to see how it worked. Could we devise a system that actually worked to get the bottles back to the nickel? That's what makes the bottle bill work. We made a number of representations to you if you were in the session of 2007, and we believe we've come through with every single one. The grocers and the distributors have worked together. Took us about a year of counseling before we got to that point, but we actually got to the point where we could work together and try and craft creative solutions. The Oregon Beverage Recycling Co-op is one of those things. And they do a marvelous job, basically, trying to get the bottles back to the nickel in a statewide fashion for product that comes into the state in many different ways. What you see in 3145 has a couple of basic concepts, some that are a little more forward-thinking than others. First of all, going back to basically the system that was out there, one of the problems that we faced was that when we put together the co-op, not everybody... Oh, thank you. I'm not sure if this was vodka, it would help a lot more.
You're wasting words.
Okay. Excuse me. what we did was we put together the co-op, but not all distributors joined the co-op. There were a few people who held out. Some of them have come back into the co-op. You can see the problem from the earlier testimony from the girls from Wood River that sorting for these folks presents a unique problem. It's expensive. It's difficult on the grocer. So part of the thing that the bill that passed during the last special session, or I guess they're not special sessions anymore, the February session, was a bill to more or less make sure that everybody really joined the co-op or the grocer didn't have to sort the product. And that was House Bill 3704, I believe, from the previous session. That also had reporting requirements where the co-op would report for everybody who was in the co-op, but everybody who was outside the co-op reported individually their own particular numbers. Both of those things are in this Dash 1 amendment, and they're necessary. You need everybody playing the game to make the game make it work. Another major problem out there, frankly, is that there are grocers that redeem product, and there are grocers that sell product. There's grocers that sell tons of product and redeem little, and there are grocers that redeem 150% or more of what they sell. The redeeming process is the expensive thing. It's not the selling. Selling is easy. It's the cost is in the redemption. So when a redemption center is built, the redeeming grocers, the Fred Meyers, the Safeways, the Albertsons, folks like that, have been participating in that redemption center. But if you happen to be a grocer that sells lots of product and you have very few people who actually come back to your store to redeem them, you don't have a lot of incentive to join in. So there's a pilot project in this, which basically says, give us an opportunity to set up a system, and it's not perfect the way it's written. It needs to be reworked. But the theory is that we would set up something somewhere, Salem, Eugene, wherever, where you would set up radiuses where different folks, and Mr. Miller will explain it in more detail, but the bottom line is to say if you're within a certain radius of a redemption center, and it's not a hard and fast radius right now, it's something that could change depending on what happens in the future, but basically if you're within a certain radius, that you have an option. You can either pay to join the redemption center like everybody else does, or you can be a redemption center yourself, which is provide the same services that anybody would get at the redemption center. And that means hand counting everything that comes in so that it's convenient for the consumer. Again, most of this hinges on consumer convenience. We also were trying to figure out a way to expand the bottle bill, because that was one of the things that we talked to you about early on. The thing we know for sure is that you cannot expand the bottle bill if you only have returned to the retailer. The retailer, it's a food store. We've already overloaded them. And the Safeways, the Freddy's, the Albertsons, those folks who are taking back a ton of stuff cannot take back more stuff. They need relief. The redemption centers were set up to do that. And what we tried to do is trigger a lot of this stuff, like expansion of the bottle bill, to when the redemption center was taking back the lion's share of the product. And that figure is somewhat, we don't know what that figure would be, but say 60, 70% of the product, something like that, going through the redemption center, that point would trigger the mechanism that would say in 1 or 2 years, whatever, after that point, you have expansion. The other thing is, how do you define expansion? We've been doing it like we did it in the original bottle bill. We defined the contents of the container. We said certain kinds of containers, plastic, aluminum, and glass. And we said if it's carbonated beverages or malt beverages. And then we added water, and then trying to define what water is. It's confusing out there. We know it's confusing. There's a store where I shop in Cannon Beach for our beach home where they charge me a deposit on everything. I've tried to explain to them that a lot of the stuff is not subject to a deposit, but they get a nickel from me for everything. I haven't tried taking it back yet. So, what we tried to do is say, what really is it that we're doing here? When we expand, what we thought is forget the content. except maybe use the content for an exemption from the expansion. What we're going to say is that every container that's cylindrical in nature, because it needs to spin for the machines, accounting things that we have right now, if it's 2 liters or less and cylindrical and it's made from aluminum, glass, or plastic, it's in. So you don't have to worry about defining what a vitamin water is versus a regular water versus a energy drink versus a juice or anything else. It's just in. But again, that trigger comes in when the redemption centers can actually handle the stuff, which hopefully will be sooner rather than later. You also, the big controversy is, why are redemption rates falling? A lot of people believe, some people believe out there, that it's because the deposit doesn't mean very much anymore. We believe it's actually because the redemption experience has become more and more difficult. We had over 90%, well into the 90% redemption rates up until around 2001 or so, and then it started falling. And again, when the people here were talking about going to redeem product, Senator Courtney's talking about it, and he's sitting there with the homeless person or that. We're pushing people away from it. If any of you have tried redeeming product at the two redemption centers that have been built out by the grocers and distributors, you will be amazed. They're incredible experiences, and they have so much made a positive out of redeeming product that it's, we believe, going to attract more people back into the system. So what we want to do is set up a system where if the commodity, either plastic, glass, or aluminum, drops below a certain amount for redemption, that could trigger the higher deposit, because then our theory may be wrong. But if as long as the redemption rate is above a certain set amount, then you don't need a higher deposit. There's no reason to pull more money out from the consumer, because frankly, a higher deposit with no bottle bill in our neighboring states will simply bring a ton of product, even more than we're already getting from across the state lines. You all remember probably the Seinfeld episode where Newman, the mailman, and whatever his name was, I forget the other one, the crazy one.
Kramer.
Yeah, not Gilliam. Concocted a scheme to take New York cans, which had New York 5 cent, Michigan 10 cent. They put them in mail trucks and they drove them to Michigan. And they were going to redeem them there. Well, everybody laughed at that except for the distributors, because that's what happens. There is a gigantic amount of fraud that goes on because you've attached, in effect, a value, significant value, to a piece of worthless trash, more or less worthless trash. Anyway, that's the basic content of what we have with these amendments. They're not complete. They're not even close to complete. There's a few people outside here who probably don't like them. There's a few people there who think they go way, way, way too far. There's a few people out there who think they don't do enough, which means that we're at least, I think, going in the right direction, because we're getting some discussion about it. The object is to make this bottle bill work. We promised you 4 years ago, and we promised you 2 years ago, and whenever we've talked about this, we promised you certain things with the bottle bill. We have always come through with those promises. We have the best bottle bill in the country. It's the most efficient, and it costs the least amount of money, and it's run by the industry with a little bit of oversight by the OLCC. But we believe that the reason it works is because we run it. We're very proud of it, and we hope that this working with you on 3145 will expand it and improve it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Romain.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I represent the Northwest Grocery Association, and I think Representative Bailey, you said it best, talking about the legacy of the bottle bill, and we are fully aware of that legacy, since the grocers and the distributors have been the ones who actually have made it work, and we've worked real hard since the first bottle bill, and obviously the expansion and a few years back expanding to water. And I think we are in that time period that you mentioned, that it's time to transition to a more convenient and an updated system. And that's what, as I just want to repeat what Mr. Romain said, we're committed to that, and we're committed by the dollars that we're investing in this system, and we do want to make it more convenient. So, Mr. Chair, I do want to say that I have summaries by section. I won't go through that today. I do want to focus, though, on the large piece of paper here of the graphs. And what this illustrates, and I'll get to this, is the current model of redemption centers that the industry has built out in two specific sites, Wood Village and Oregon City, and give you some information, some data on those sites, and then talk about the pilot project that we would like to test. And mainly that's because we've learned a lot from these pilot projects, and I think we will learn a lot more. We've learned a lot from these current centers, and we want to learn a little bit more from the pilot project. But going back to the Wood Village, Oregon City experience, these are redemption centers built on a different system to make it more convenient. As Paul indicated, people are not going to the grocery store because of the experience, because of the convenience. And so OBRC has done a fantastic job of getting people back into the system that weren't necessarily redeeming their bottles. And what they've done is a bottle drop system where you can set up an account very easily. Have a barcoded bags. You can drop those off, have those hand counted, and have your account credited. It's an online account. For many people in this busy environment, folks who don't want to be involved at the grocery store in those areas, redeeming, these are much cleaner, more convenient facilities. And what we found is there's about 4,000 accounts signed up for the bottle drop in the first in Wood Village. I'll use that as an example. And in the zone, the convenient zone that was approved by OLCC, there was two retailers that had about $9.5 million in annual redemption that was taken offline because those people were going to go to the redemption center.
You all, containers.
What's that?
Containers.
Containers, I'm sorry. You had within that 2 mile, you also had non-participating retailers, so you weren't giving up a person that could still go to a grocery store and even outside those areas, even with convenience stores. So you still had return to retail even in those convenience zones. Right now, just the Wood Village facility is currently on pace to redeem about 14 million containers. And so, again, these were two stores that were 9.5 million. We are greatly increasing the amount of redemption and the amount of containers through that redemption center. What we've learned is that not necessarily, or people are not necessarily using it for how close they are. And so the second in the middle graph illustrates that about 30% of the people that have signed up for this program, 30% are within the 2 mile radius of those of the redemption center. About 45% that have signed up for the bottle drop is within a 5 mile radius, and then outside that 5 mile radius, there's about a 25% of the people that are using the bottle drop that are coming in because of the convenience and the experience that they're getting at these redemption centers. So now I want to compare this to the Section 7 of the Dash 1 amendments, which you should have, and a concept that we would like to test because of what we've learned. One of the things that we've learned in these two redemption centers is that they're not big enough. We are just the amount of containers going through here, we actually need to make these bigger, which, given the numbers, we don't necessarily know if we need as many as we thought we did before. I think we were projecting probably 90 redemption centers to cover about 70% of the volume that goes through the grocery stores, which are my members. And so we may need less, but it's something that we should test. And so what the Section 7 of the pilot project in the Dash 1 amendments tries to do is expand the radius now of the convenience zone, but do some very important things while we expand it. We still have the 2 mile radius, and the 2 mile radius, if you are within that, you can choose to participate, you can choose not to participate. If you choose to, you pay the full cost. If you're within the 5-mile radius, you can also participate in the Redemption Center, and it would be half the cost. And again, that's the business model of OBRC. But you would still be required to take back 24 return to retail in those establishments. C-stores, whether you're, and it's again a convenience store, under 5,000 square feet, which is in the current existing bottle bill, whether you're within the 2-mile or the 5-mile, you would still stay at the, or actually be reduced to 24 in-store versus the 50 in-store now currently. But the key is the non-participating retailers. Again, if whether you're within the 2-mile or the 5-mile, you would be required to basically have the same services of the Redemption Center. So you can choose to participate or not, but you'd have to have the same requirement. And one of those requirements we're putting in the bill, instead of the 144 in-store requirement that current law has, we would actually raise that to 300. So you would actually be able to bring back more per day at the either the Redemption Center, or if you choose not to, they would have to accept 300 as well. That is basically the model, and what we found is this will give us a good indication of how we get to being able to take back the volume that we're contemplating while increasing the redemption rate. Again, when we talk to you about the triggers involved and what we're just proposing, and again, these are concepts in the Dash 1 amendments that I've talked to both the co-chairs about, but once we build out this system, our goal is to make it more convenient for the consumer. You're still going to have return to retail because we're not completely eliminating that component. But we feel by doing that, we are more than willing to look at the expansion piece and having that discussion. And again, we feel on the 80% trigger regarding redemption rates and going to a dime, we are very hopeful we can get there without the dime. Now, I know there is folks who think the dime is necessary. We take the belief that it's the convenience and the experience that drives up that that redemption rate. And so, but again, we are open to having that discussion on the trigger, as Paul outlined in the sections 3 regarding the 10 cent, and also the expansion piece in section 2 of the bill. And so, again, this lays out the pilot. We're fully committed to building out this system because we think it's the right way to go. We think it expands upon the legacy of the bottle bill. And I guess with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Sean. I think Representative Berger appreciates, and I'm sure others do as well, the significance of having both of you here sitting side by side bringing a bottle bill concept to us. And
I wish it wasn't today.
Yeah, keep your distance. And I want to publicly express my gratitude for your work on these Dash 1 amendments. Obviously, they need some additional maintenance. You have been at the table helping create the table on this proposal for at least a year, and appreciate that. I think what is quite clear to me is this is Oregon's bottle bill, and the people who really work it, the people who really run it, are the distributors, are the grocers. They are making incredible investments in these redemption centers, in the recycling infrastructure that makes the bottle bill possible. We should be careful to work with you on how to improve it. So thank you for your work on this. Are there any questions for two of them? Great.
Thank you.
Thanks. Hope you feel better, Paul.
Thanks.
Yeah. We'll hear next from Rick Winterhalter, Katie Daly, Rob Guttridge.
Put you on either side.
Hi. Go ahead. Who's up first?
I'm first. Okay. Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Cannon, representatives, my name's Rick Winterhalter. I am the current chair of the Association of Oregon Recyclers. The association is a not-for-profit coalition of individuals, governments, not-for-profit organizations, and businesses committed to encouraging waste prevention and recycling in Oregon. It's happy to be here to have this discussion. I think, as Representative Berger said, it does start getting a little complicated. And we started, I think, back in 2003 working towards this with everybody who you've heard from already. So, and over 40 years ago, Governor Tom McCall called this passage of the bottle bill and implementation one of the most innovative of his 10 years in state government. And at signing, he kind of claimed that this was the most significant act of state legislature to turn us away from use and waste to a positive program of reuse and save. So on the surface, I think some folks have said, you know, the beauty of the bill at the time, at the passage, was in its simplicity of turning back to the businesses that had, before the no deposit, no return days, taken back all of their containers for refilling. And so it was simply an ask, can you go back and do what you were doing before? And then they've done so beautifully, I think. The system does work. It took care of litter. The non-covered containers are littered at twice the rate. The plastic bottles are recovered at twice the rate of curbside programs in this system. And manufacturers using materials, the plastic, the metals, and the glass, say that the material coming from bottle bill states and that type of recovery is some of the cleanest commodities that they use back in their system. And it's always been made very convenient for consumers. And so, because we turn them where they're sold. There are some changes, I think, that are coming along that will do that as well. The association has been working for several years, as we said, for modernizing the bottle bill to bring on additional containers, because, you know, the containers that we're drinking now or that our kids are drinking now, you know, weren't around in 71. We would like to increase the refund value. We've always indicated that the recovery from the state of Michigan with a higher higher refund value has a highest redemption rate of bottle bill states. Every time California has increased their refund value or the redemption value, they see an increase in the returns. And we want to, you know, maintain the convenience. In 2007, we were able to add water bottles, and it was a positive step. I think, you know, the industry stepped up, has taken those bottles back, and has done a really, really good job with that. They have set up, and in that time, they wanted, you know, some waiting so that they could take on the volume that was going to happen when these water bottles came on. And they did add two redemption centers, and it is worth a trip to see these redemption centers. They've done a very nice job with them. They are very convenient. They're very clean. People like using them. The only concern I have that I kind of heard that we had talked about, I think it was brought up about having 90. If the grocers, if folks were going to get together, then we would make sure that we kind of had 90 of these things throughout the state. That's what we had heard in the past. And I heard today that that number may go down a little bit. But as everybody has indicated so far, we certainly want to continue the conversation. There's more work to be done. So, HB 3145, as introduced, accomplishes many of the things that we've been waiting for, adding modern beverages in 2014, increasing the refund value in 2015. So those are, you know, very worthwhile. We would certainly like to see those things come to fruition, and we'd really like to see a modernized bottle bill come to fruition, and we're more than willing to accept the introduced bill or work with the committee on the proposed amendments that are in front of you, because I think we can come to some really good conclusions.
Thank you. Kate?
Good afternoon, Chairs Cannon and Gilliam, members of the committee. My name is Katie Daly. I'm co-president of Recycling Advocates, Oregon's citizens-based grassroots group dedicated to creating a sustainable future through reducing, reusing, and recycling. I want to begin by reminding everybody that this year is the 40th anniversary of the passage of the original bottle bill. Back in January, late January, we threw a celebration that was a wonderful celebration. Over 200 people, diverse amount of people that were in this room and throughout the state came and heard stories from Representative Hanneman and Representative Berger about kind of the origins of the bill and stories. Little bit of sketchiness with 80-year-olds standing on milk crates because we didn't really have a good podium for them. So nobody fell. It was good. Representative Berger's new hip is all okay. But other than that, it was a really wonderful, I think, recommitment to the bottle bill and to the efforts to modernize it and realization that we really do need to be here today to talk about the future of it, and there's more to do. We've been focusing much of our efforts on bottle bill modernization over the last few years for our organization, and we are enthusiastically supportive of 3145 as it was introduced, especially the following provisions. As Rick said, you know, expanding the number of containers that are covered to really represent what's being sold in markets today and what's being consumed by Oregonians. When the bottle bill originally passed, it covered the majority of the beverages that were being sold, and we really need to, you know, after 40 years, we included water and water-like beverages, but there's still a lot more out there that could be covered that isn't, and a lot of materials, unfortunately, going to the landfill that we can capture and recycle. You know, and the only difference is, I think the girls from Hood River said, people are confused about it. The only difference is the type of liquid that's in them. The containers are often the same containers. Introducing confusion into the mix does, I think, dampen some of the enthusiasm and the participation in using the bottle bill. So we strongly support increasing the number of containers. I think when I read back on my testimony in 2007, the statistics that were used at the time from 2007 was that containers covered by the bottle bill are recycled at a rate of 82% or through the system at 80%, while it is 37% for non-covered containers. So it's a significant amount of boost to recycling rates that the bottle bill gives to recycling rates throughout the state on those that are covered. So as it's written, we definitely support you know, increasing the number of containers on or before 2014. I'd like to address the Dash 1 amendments at some point in time, and I don't know if now is the right time since it sounds like there's still a lot of work to be done in solidifying some of the blanks that are left inside of those. But Recycling Advocates does support the original date of 2014. The second point, I think, obviously raising the refund value of beverage containers from 5 to 10 cents. You know, we agree that the convenience is a big issue in why the redemption rates have gone down. But it definitely is a combination of inflation and what is a nickel today versus a nickel yesterday. And you know, whether it's worth somebody's time to actually take the time to redeem their containers. Just parenthetically, I was at a QFC during lunch right by Grant High School, and I saw a Grant High School student drop a quarter and look at it and leave it and walk away. So if that's what the youth of today are doing with their quarters, you can imagine what's happening to the 5-cent cans and bottles out there. So maybe 10 cents isn't enough. And so we support the original language of, you know, raising the rate to 10 cents in 2015 or before if possible. You know, And understand, again, we'd like to see the Dash 1 amendment solidified and talk about what our position is and hopefully work with you on where we can get to bring that up to 10 cents. We officially have no position on the remaining provisions of House Bill 3145, except that we generally support the efforts of OBRC to create clean, convenient, full-service redemption centers to improve the experience of consumers who want to return their containers and to ultimately improve return rates and recycling rates for bottle bill containers. So with respect to the Dash 1 amendments, we haven't fully evaluated them. We don't feel like we can adequately comment on them. There are some concerns that we have with some of the things that we saw, and would like to work with the committee on clarifying some of the things that are left unclarified. You know, we obviously support raising the deposit to 10 cents, dividing it up by container type. is probably something that we could talk about and is doable. But the goal is to raise some of the more valuable container types, such as aluminum, even higher than the return rate that we're getting right now. And if we use a trigger point that is below what we're already getting for aluminum, then we don't really meet the goals, I think, of trying to modernize the bottle bill and bring some of those return rates higher to where we need to be given the valuable commodity that aluminum is. So I would like to talk about, you know, what we can do to make sure that we do raise the deposit, the return rates for all types of beverage containers. And then as far as the list of beverages that are included, I think that I was a little confused reading the amendments that were out there, so I don't know that we can necessarily comment at this time, but would like to work with the committee again. And then as far as the pilot project is concerned, there's a...
Can you wrap it up, Katie?
Absolutely. So we do have a lot... I think there's some things in the pilot project that we support. Obviously, without having more definition about where it might go, downtown Portland's a little bit different than, say, Hood River or other locations. You know, we have some concerns about where it might go, but other than that, I think there are some good things in the pilot project that we would support. So thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you. Good.
Rob Guttridge. Thank you, co-chairs, for the opportunity to testify. Rob Guttridge, I'm a former chair of the Association of Oregon Recyclers and a former chair of Recycling Advocates and a longtime recycler. I'm maybe the only person in the room who actually used the original deposit redemption center in Estacada that was established way back in the 1970s because I was a student there at that time. And I view the bottle bill as an important part of being an Oregonian anymore. It's like an old, well-worn coat. It just needs a little repair to keep it working, and I think this is a bill that moves it forward and updates it and brings it into the 21st century. I support the bill as originally introduced, and I hope that we have an opportunity to look at these amendments because we have just seen them and there are some problematic things perhaps in them that can be resolved, and I look forward to the bill being an improvement and a path forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any questions for this panel? Seeing none, you're excused. Thanks for being here. Thank you for the opportunity. Great. We have maybe, looks like, 5 more folks to testify. Committee, we did send out notice we'd be running late this evening, but hopefully not too late because we're getting towards the end of our work. Let's go next. Mark Nelson, Richard Kosison, I don't know if you're both here. Mark is Craig Smith. Bring you up as well.
Co-Chair Cannon and Gilliam, thank you so much for having us here. I'm Craig Smith, Vice President of Northwest Food Processors Association, and here to talk to you about the Dash 1 amendments in particular. Redemption centers and the pilot projects and all that are really not our issue, but our major issue with this is the labeling aspects, because we're the folks who put the labels on the products and tell the consumer how much the redemption rate is. And the way the Dash 1 amendments are formulated is extremely complicated. And I spent a long time trying to write this down for you, and I really wasn't able to do it in a way that I thought was even understandable. So if you'll bear with me just a sec, I brought a demonstration today I think will work better, because this is what we see in the bill. I've got 5 different containers here that are going to be treated completely differently under the bill. The first one here is a V8 bottle that is under 2 liters, and so under the redemption, once we hit the redemption triggers, some fairly significant changes in the way the current bill works kick into action. OLCC would then determine the redemption rate. They would do a rulemaking process, and then each year after that, they would evaluate whether we meet the redemption, the 80% number or not. Under that rulemaking process, the definition of a container is cylindrical. This is a bottle that is round at top, round on the bottom, and has 6 sides in the middle. It's not clear to me whether this is cylindrical, so we don't know whether this is in or out, and we don't know what the deposit rate is. And if rulemaking is done on an annual basis, under the way the rule is designed, the new deposit rate takes effect on January 1st of the following year. So if, for instance, OLCC completed their rulemaking process on December 1st, the following January would kick in the new rates. That would give us 30 days to change labels. And basically what would happen there is the retailers will send those products back to us because they're mislabeled now. And so we would have no ability to get those labels changed in that time. This is a nightmare for us. And so I'm here opposed to the Dash 1s because this is a real problem for us. Here is a second product. This is a V8 juice drink. This is exactly the same product as the one that's in the plastic. This is a steel can. This can comes in under this rule. It's not included in any bottle bill in the nation today, but it does come in because the rule says metal cans. It doesn't have a recycling rate in it because it's not called out, so it would default to the 5-cent rate. But that can comes in under this bill because it is cylindrical, it is a beverage, and it is under 2 liters. So that's an unintended consequence. But again, you can see that this is a bit of a problem for us. This is a pretty straightforward one. This is an organic tea. It's a glass bottle. But again, we have 3 categories in the bill: aluminum, plastic, glass. So we're not sure what the recycling rate is going to be on this container. It's going to require relabeling potentially. Again, very confusing. Here's a competitor product, Clamato, made by Mott's, that would be a competitor for V8. This would be sitting right on the shelf next to this plastic bottle, but this one's out because it's square. It's not required to have a redemption value because it's not cylindrical. And then this is kind of the most unusual, I think, consequence of the bill. This is a water bottle, Icelandic glacial natural spring water. This bottle is currently required to have a deposit in the state of Oregon, but under this bill, because it's square, would no longer be required to have a deposit. And so you can see from a manufacturer's perspective, this is a confusing, it took me hours, frankly, to figure out whether this was even right or not, and I'm still not absolutely sure. So I apologize if I've misread the bill, but I don't think I have. This is a really, really confusing set of regulations, and we'd really ask you not to do this to us. We're all for the bottle bill. This is not about the bottle bill. This is about making it work. I don't think this is going to be an improvement. So thank you very much.
Thanks for your testimony. Richard, Mark. Who's up?
Co-Chair Cannon and Co-Chair Gilliam. My name is Mark Nelson. I'm here today representing 7-Eleven, but I should also let you know that I represent also the Northwest Food Processors Association and also Anheuser-Busch. And both 7-Eleven and Anheuser-Busch are opposed to this legislation. There are 4 primary issues in the Dash 1 amendments. The first is bottle bill expansion, which I'll talk to shortly, and then deposit increase, redemption center, for the lack of a better word, domination or control of this process. And last but not least, it's really, as Representative Berger said, the bottle bill politics is really, she didn't say this, I'm adding to her phraseology, it's all about money. It's all, and as everyone has watched the bottle bill politics through the years, you have winners and you have losers, and winners and losers are usually depending upon who's paying, who's receiving, and again, it's all about money. As you know, we have expanded recently, or in 2007, to include water and flavored water in the bottle bill. That process is still unfolding. The redemption rate on plastic now, I understand, is around 50%, which means Oregonians in this state are paying a nickel on half of the bottles that are never returned. In other words, the unredeemed deposits for water is substantial, and I'll touch upon that shortly. The amendments in the bill, I'll concur with Craig Smith are very confusing and very, very hard to follow. On page section one, we say that a beverage container means a container described in section two. And section two, basically, we're saying any liquid intended for human consumption in a beverage container. We then go on and we talk about containers that are in first and three fluid liters, and then we drop down to two fluid liters. And this is where, again, I get lost. Then we talk about, as Craig has indicated, a metal, and I totally missed that. I read it as aluminum. Obviously, metal is not aluminum, or it's different. And so that's a brand new addition. In the sub 2B, we go from 3 fluid liters back down to 2, and then we exclude any containers that hold liquor, wine, or milk. And does that mean in the upper, in B, in A, it doesn't include those? Again, and then we add cylindrical. And for a layperson, which I really am in terms of this bottle bill, the language is very, very confusing. I want to remind that 7-Eleven, and Richard Kosan will speak to his stores, 7-Eleven simply doesn't have the room. If we're not part of this process, and I know there are pilot programs, but for this type of expansion, we just don't have the capability of dealing with this. And depending upon which stores go in and are out, as you know, there's an exclusion for small stores. Another important issue from our point of view is the use of the word return for the refund value, which you find on page 3 and throughout the bill. We're really talking about, when you set a percentage, about the redemption rate and not the recycled rate. As you know, we have curbside. We're going to continue to have curbside. And as you set a percentage as a line that if you fall below, we're going to raise the deposit, you have to somehow be able to look at the total return rate, both on curbside and through the redemption centers. So to set the rate at only what is returned to the redemption centers, I think is a basic mistake. And you have to be able to look at the recycled rate in the state. I believe you can get there with what DEQ does, but still, I think that is a flaw. If that is going to be our trigger, the 10 cents, I think that's a problem. I know you have other people, and we can always come back. I want to just finish with the 10 cents. From our point of view, for plastic, as I indicated earlier, you have a low redemption rate now. I don't know what the recycled rate is if you count at curbside, but we are moving money in this bill from the pockets of some Oregonians to the pockets of other Oregonians. I don't want to call this a tax because it's a deposit that is returned. But in the end, it's a tax on somebody who doesn't have, and this isn't returned. When you now move into all these other items, as Craig has said, you will start with a very low redemption rate, and you're going to have huge unredeemed deposits. Huge. Now, are you going to increase the recycling of these items? Yes, that recycling will increase, but you're still going to create a huge amount of money that's going to be flowing to the Oregon Beverage Recycling Co-op. And that's just a fact. And I think that money is substantial. And I think that's, again, what's driving a lot of the economics behind this bill. And the bottle bill, as again, I'm going to repeat as I started at the beginning, has always been about economics and winners and losers. So I'll conclude there, Mr. Chairman, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Nesson. Richard, why don't you go, and then we'll see if there are questions.
Thank you, Chair Cannon and Co-Chair Gilliam. Richard Kosasan, I represent the Oregon Neighborhood Store Association, which primarily consists of small retail establishments throughout the state of Oregon. I should note that I also represent the International Bottled Water Association, along with Miller Coors. All three entities are opposed to the provisions found in the Dash 1 amendments of House Bill 3145. Like the previous speaker, and I think talking to others, we've had a difficult time, I think, managing and understanding all provisions contained in those amendments, but they are somewhat, or to me, they are somewhat convoluted. The increased deposit, we would argue that it's not the time. If you take a case of water, for example, retail, many times when you're out and about on a weekend, you see a case of water for $3.99. The deposit on that today, $1.20. Going to a dime, you've increased it to $2.40. That's more than half the cost at retail. I think that would be a fairly significant, dramatic change, and it would be viewed as a disincentive at the retail level. In terms of the expansion, the young lady from Hood River, Miss Middleton, I believe, spoke about lack of redemption on water bottles, which I think is an interesting facet. But she explained very nicely that one of the individuals that she was dealing with was completely unaware that there was a deposit on water bottles. And I would contend very strongly, and I think Chair Cannon, you heard some testimony about a year ago on the rates, the differential rates between aluminum, glass, and PET. And PET was substantially lower than those of the other two. And I think that is part lack of adjustment to the deposit on water bottles that went into effect January 1, 2009. Rather than increase the deposit, I would suggest that the state and advocates take a look at a strong educational endeavor. In terms of the pilot projects contemplated through House Bill 3145, I would encourage the committee to take a look at the provisions, specifically starting on page 6 of the proposed amendments and page 7. As Mr. Nelson previously indicated, when Senate Bill 707 passed in 2007, allowances were provided, and I think very prudently, for small stores, and those stores being less than 5,000 square feet. The reason for that, they simply do not have backroom space to deal with the containers. And the way we've set this up, it's, I guess, a system of very polite blackmail to suggest that a small retailer basically has no option but to participate with the co-op. A small retail establishment may desire to participate, not participate with a redemption center. I think that's an option. I don't think it's equitable to set a system here that basically forces a small retailer to automatically and mandatorily participate in a program. And those provisions can be found specifically on page 7, subsection E. Any dealer doing business in either convenience zone that does not participate in the pilot project must provide services similar to those provided by the pilot project and must hand count empty beverage containers that are returned for the refund value established by 459705. And that would include, I think, if I read the amendments correctly, an increased number of containers, but with the expansion, again, I get back to the issue that the small retail establishment simply does not have the space. Again, I think Mr. Nelson was on target. I would encourage some consideration given to the distinction between redemption rates and recycling rates. The way the amendments are constructed to date, it looks like we focus entirely on redemption as opposed to recycling. Long term, the endeavor should be one of recycling. With that, Mr. Chair and Co-Chair Gilliam, thank you, and I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Thanks, Richard. Let's see if there are questions.
Down your breath.
Representative Witt?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was interested perhaps in more in-depth understanding of kind of Richard's concerns about forcing certain sellers of beverages to, in essence, have to join the cooperative. Could you be more explicit about how that force would work?
Co-Chair Cannon and Representative Witt, I was trying to weave my way through the amendments.
Okay.
And they make a distinction between dealers, those being the retail establishments, with maintaining more than 500 or 5,000 square feet, and then specifically found on page 7, it starts with subsection D, mm-hmm. dealers doing business in either convenience zone that occupies space of less than 5,000 square feet may participate in the program. But then you go to subsection E, if a dealer doing business in either convenience zone does not participate in the pilot project, they must provide services similar to those provided by the pilot project and must provide hand counting of empty beverage containers. So to me, the way the amendments are constructed, it seems like it's a very polite way to say and to suggest very clearly that you basically will participate in the pilot project and you will participate as everybody else.
I think there may be a clarification on that point, and there have been several allusions to some of the drafting issues that we may have here, and I realize why you're reading it the way you're reading it. I think the intent was not to require small dealers to participate in the pilot project. The intent was to require dealers over 5,000 square feet to participate if they're within that convenience zone or to provide equal services. And Mr. Romain is nodding his head that was the intent. I don't know whether that's what the amendment says. I see why you're reading it that way.
Well, Chair Cannon, and I could be misreading it very readily. We were not included in the discussions in the formation of the amendments, so it's, I think they caught a lot of people by surprise.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would suspect that there is at least one dealership within my district that would be adversely impacted by this, and I am wondering if there are any antitrust implications from this kind of scenario. And has anyone considered that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, not that I'm aware of. We haven't gotten them. We just received these 2 days ago, so we're looking at them very carefully. But certainly that is should be a concern of some people. I mean, clearly, this is designed to favor the one cooperative that is there. That's very clear. And they are building those redemption centers. I want to point out they're building those redemption centers basically with what I believe, and maybe there's much more investment being made, is being built with unredeemed deposits. And people need to understand that. And again, this is a way, this is why we believe everything is, that's why everything's going to come in, and that nickel is going to be there in all these new items. It's going to produce a lot of unredeemed deposits, and it's why we believe that it will, the current nickel on the current aluminum glass and plastic bottles is going to also go up another nickel. And now while the redemption rate will increase, I'm sure that will happen as you increase that deposit, but so will the total dollar amount of the unredeemed deposits, which I believe is substantial now and will get much larger and will help fund these redemption centers. I mean, that's what we're doing here. And we're doing that, let's look at it for what it is. We're doing that out of pockets for Oregonians. They're going to pay, as Mr. Kosen said, $2.40
for that water bottle, or that 24 package of water bottles, and they're going to return half for whatever reason. And that money is going to go to fund this endeavor. And that's what we're doing here.
Anything further?
Mr. Chairman, I would benefit from a legislative council's advice on this issue, if you would consider that.
Absolutely. We can certainly get that. Anything for this panel? Representative Gilliam.
Representative Thompson.
Representative Thompson.
I'm going to put this out as more of a statement than the question, because I don't expect you people to know the answer to it. But we're talking about the pilot redemption centers and the need to expand them to larger centers. I'm more interested in what the smallest economic unit is. I represent rural parts of five counties. And if this were to be a problem of distribution, it would be a big problem, because my people would be paying a dime and driving to Oregon City or somewhere to drop off their cans. I would be very interested to know what the planned distribution is of these centers and what the plan is for rural Oregon. I can't imagine we're going to have a high-density situation in Harney County or Lake County or Polk County or any number of them. So I can see where this is a great idea for urban, suburban areas, but I think there's going to have to be a piece of this that addresses convenience in rural areas, which happens to be almost all of Oregon.
Representative Thompson, I think that's a terrific question, and we have heard, this committee has heard in the past, testimony from the OVRC, which is establishing these redemption centers. They've, I think, mentioned some of their thoughts about the way that they might modify that system with kiosks or some other approach to rural Oregon, and it's a issue that I think you're pointing out we should hear more about.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have any response to that, but it does seem like something that's sort of geared towards the folks who are establishing the redemption centers, who are not the folks in front of us now. Is there anything further, Representative Gilliam?
Craig, thank you for coming. Thank you all for coming. And I'm sorry we're at odds on this particular issue, but this is really not a question as much as if I'd like to offer a service, if you would accept it.
Sure. Thank you.
We'd prefer a plastic.
Plastic.
I know you would.
Well, see, I was at Fred Meyer. You got the same sack I do. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Very good, Representative.
I knew I was going to get in trouble when I walked in the building with that plastic sack.
Thank you. We have just a couple more folks. We're going to hear last from the Palmer DQ, Palmer from DQ, and Thomas Irwin from OLCC. If you'll keep your comments brief, I think we can scurry on out of here before the nighttime.
Hi, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality. Thank you for having me here and letting me testify on this issue. I just want to say quickly that the department has historically supported the bottle bill and is very interested in being a part of the conversation as we move forward. Many of the questions that were raised about the amendments are things that we have ourselves with the amendments, trying to figure out how they best apply. But it should not be lost, hopefully, on anybody that the bottle bill has been very successful in generating a clean stream of recyclable materials. It does return most of the materials at a pretty high rate. If it would be helpful, I can sort of share the numbers. If we're talking cans, it's 83.9%. If it's glass, it's 79.9%. And the plastics is about 54%, and that's based on 2009 data. And we're hopeful and believe that the experience with the bottle bill shows that the plastic return rate will come up over time. Certainly, though, people need to understand that it's available to them, and I think a lot of people don't know that that's an option, that they can get a deposit for returning a plastic container. Also, the bottle bill is very successful in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. We think the average or the savings that equate to the return from the bottle bill is about 40,000 cars a year. and also a great deal of savings in terms of energy usage. We think the materials that are recovered under the bottle bill equate to about 24 million gallons of gasoline. So there's a lot of there's a strong environmental case for looking at the bottle bill. But just quickly add that based on the experience in other states, increasing the refund value does drive the recycling rate to higher and higher amounts. And I did want to share with the committee, when you look at the three container types, plastic, metal, and glass, we think the overall recovery rate is around 72%. And then the question was asked about curbside. You would add about another 6% with curbside. So we'd give you a total number of recovery around 78%. But experience, again, in other states suggests that increasing the refund value, excuse me, does drive the recycling quite a bit higher. Also, it would be important, I think, for the committee to note that when the bottle bill was originally passed in 1971, it pretty much covered the containers, the single-serving containers that were sold at the time. The market has changed. We now have teas and coffees and sports drinks and all that sort of thing. So I think it's appropriate for the legislature to be considering whether an expansion would make sense at this time now. And then also I wanted to comment that we agree with what the retailers and the distributors are talking about. It's time, I think, to look at a system of redemption centers. As Representative Thompson pointed out, they may not all, it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. We have rural Oregon, we have urban Oregon, and we need to figure out a model that works. But there's clearly a demographic that wants to take a lot of containers back to a single location and be served efficiently and effectively. And it's probably doesn't make sense to make the retailers do all of that in their stores. So I think there's a need to talk about a different approach here, and so we're encouraged by that. And I'll just stop there and say that we, again, would like to be part of the conversation. In any way we can help the committee and the legislature on this issue, we'd like to do it.
Great.
Thanks.
Thanks, Palmer.
Tom? Good afternoon, Co-Chair Cannon, Co-Chair Gillen, and members of the committee. I'm Tom Irwin. I'm the Government Affairs and Communications Director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I'll keep my remarks very brief. The commissioners and the commission have been supportive of the bottle bill and obviously are enforcing the bottle bill and have been charged with that since 1971. We helped for the expansion with bottled water that was added back in 2007. And the commissioners actually took a support position of the original House Bill 3145. We just got to see the amendments to the bill yesterday, so they haven't had an ability, or we haven't had an ability as staff to give them a recommendation about the amendments. But there are a few things that our staff has discovered in looking them over and that we wanted to bring to your attention real quickly. One of them issues is that the amendment has identified areas. Well, let me start over. The first is the concept of kind of beverage. In the past, the bottle bill has definitions under kind, which is what is redeemable. The Dash 1 amendments seem not to use that phraseology. So we have kind of beverages used in several other relating statutes, ORS 459A, 710, 715, and 735. So if the intent is to define beverages in a new manner, these are other statutes that we would also either need to be amended or try to clarify so that there's not inconsistencies when we're applying the law. We at least think that that's part of the issue here that we would like to be addressed. Secondly, you all probably are aware that the two redemption centers that are currently cited, we went through a long process with advisory committee hearings and stakeholders at the table trying to define what was an area of convenience. And it was a great struggle. And I think there were a lot of stakeholders who are still concerned about what that area entails. So to the extent that the legislators are able to provide more guidance as to what convenience is and the convenience area defined in the new statute, we would appreciate that if there are going to be these 2-mile and then an additional 3-mile radius or whatever it's come up with. If we could define that clearly or at least in legislative intent, that would be helpful to the agency because I don't really think we want to go through that again. The amendments do require more oversight than we currently provide. I think there's no question about it. We don't have expertise in recycling rates, and while None of this is specified in the bill itself. Obviously, we can reach out to our sister agency, DEQ, and ask them for some assistance in all of this, and we will do that informally. We would do that regardless of what was in the intent of the statute, and I don't know if you want to put that in there specifically, that partnership is in there, but we would love it if it was. If it's not, we'll continue to do our informal process. It's just that we don't, again, have the expertise to be judging whether those recycling rates are hit, I don't think, other than the percentages that you arrive at. So, finally, the other part of this that I wanted to bring up, I brought up in the past. We have, and Representative Witt may be interested in this particularly, we have an inconsistency in our ability to apply enforcement standards on the bottle bill between liquor license establishments and non-liquor license establishments. We can suspend a liquor license establishment's license. We have that authority. But with a non-liquor licensed establishment, if they're doing something that's a willful violation of the bottle bill, it's a criminal violation, and probably a Class A misdemeanor, as I recall. So I don't know if the legislators have any interest at all in trying to add that to the equation. It is. I'm not trying to add something that you don't want to do, but there is an inconsistent ability for us to apply the enforcement standards in this area. So we would love it if we could have some language that would apply to that. And that's all I have.
Thanks. Yeah. Any questions? Seeing none, I think we'll leave it there. Thank you for being here. We'll, with that, close the public hearing on House Bill 3145. Carry over the work session to Tuesday. Possible carryovers beyond that, but for now, carry it over, House Bill 3145 to Tuesday. And before we adjourn the committee, I just want to check with staff that we're not leaving anything behind.
Okay.
We're okay. Sound good? With that, we will adjourn the Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water. Thanks.
Thank you.